This evening, I'm going to be channeling Dr. Feierstein. Unfortunately, the recorder didn't work this morning. We think that the buttons are too easily pushed and you turn it off by mistake. So I'm going to tape this one, and it's not quite as good, but I'll do my best. But Dr. Feierstein will be here next week, and that's his email. If you have any questions after this lecture or next time, you can ask me, but you can also go straight to the source. Now, the first thing I want to talk about is the brain. And the question is, why is the brain so special? And of course, we think the brain is so special because it makes us us. It endows our personality. And I'd like to read you a definition of the brain from Ambrose Bierce, who wrote The Devil's Dictionary. He defined the brain as the apparatus we think with. And that's probably pretty good. Woody Allen says it's his second most favorite organ. Now, we want to talk about the brain and about neurons today because we've been talking about communication between cells of a chemical nature, and today we want to talk about electrical communication. But we're going to start with the brain. And the brain has really three special features which contribute to its importance. One of them is diversity. One is plasticity, and the other is what it actually does, which is information processing and transfer. Now, the reason we bring up diversity is because the brain is composed of many different kinds of neurons. Now, it also has support cells, which we'll talk about later. But if you just stick to neurons, all neurons don't look the same. There's a wide range of structure. So there's diversity in morphology, which just means structure, and there's diversity in function. The labor is divided up among the brain cells, and they don't all work the same. Now, what do we mean by plasticity? The brain learns. That's learning is probably the primary example of plasticity. But the brain responds both to the environment and it responds to experience. And it does that both through development and it does that through adult life. Now, the reason that's so remarkable is that the brain does it without cell division. That brain cells, in a way, are the most highly specialized cells there are. And they combine being extremely highly specialized and differentiated with this plasticity. Now, what do I mean by doing it without cell division? When you're born, you have just about all the brain cells you're ever going to have. And unfortunately, you lose them with age. But not till you get to about 20, and then it starts to fall. So you're born with all that you're going to get. But still, the connections that they make change with time, and that's why we have plasticity. Now, I didn't mention it when I talked about morphology, but one of the things that's so important about neurons is the variation in size. Some neurons are extremely small, and some neurons are enormous. The biggest neuron, I guess, is in the blue whale. There's one about 40 meters long. But in you, the longest one is about a meter, and that goes from the middle of your back down to your toe. And that's probably, and that's one single cell, goes all the way from one to the other. And we'll discuss cell neuron structure in a minute and see how a cell can be that long. Now, what about their function? The idea that they transfer information is not unique to brain cells. The cells that make hormones transfer information. But there's a difference in that information transfer and processing with nerve cells is faster, first of all. It's extremely rapid. And it's specific. And it's long distance. Now, I guess you could say it's long distance with some hormones also, that the hormone is released in one place and goes to quite a distance place. But it's not so specific with hormones. With hormones, you have a general broadcast to all parts of the body. But a nerve can go just to your little toe and not to your big toe. And a hormone can't do that. It's all the toes or none. So you have a specific dedicated line in a nerve. And by rapid, we just mean that information can be passed down a nerve much more quickly than it can through the circulation. Now, one way of summing all of this up is fairly obvious, but that you have input, you have processing, and you have output. And you do it rapidly, specifically, and long distance. Now, we've been talking about the brain. The nervous system is actually divided into two main parts, and the brain is part of one of them. It's the entire nervous system is divided into the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system, or the PNS. Now, the central nervous system is the brain that we've been talking about and the spinal cord. And the peripheral nervous system is basically everything else. You have, we talked about input and output. You have sensory neurons, which pick up taste, smell, etc. That's input. It goes into the brain, and the output is, among other things, motor neurons. That's what makes your big muscles move. But there are other parts of the peripheral nervous system. For example, you have a set of nerves which govern the behavior of your GI tract. And in addition, there's what's called the autonomic nervous system. And this covers many other functions, and I'm not going to go into it because we're going to talk about this next week. Now, the basic unit of all of these is the neuron. And that's what I want to talk about for most of today. That's the functional unit. Now, a neuron is a cell. So one way of looking at this is, what are the general features of a neuron that are just we can take over from everything else that we've talked about cells? And what is it that's special about a neuron that allows it to carry out its communication function? If we think about the brain, it turns out that the brain has, in an adult, there are 10 to the 11 neurons in a brain. Now, it seems obvious to us that the brain is made of cells. But this was not obvious until around 1900. People thought earlier, because that the brain consisted of a net of things connected to each other, not individual cells, but some kind of fused network. And one of the reasons they thought that is that if you open the brain and look, everything appears to be connected to everything, and all you see is a mess. But in the early 1900s, there's a Spanish neuroscientist who was basically the founder of modern neuroscience, and his name is Ramón y Cajal. It's his last name. And he was the first to stain the brain using what's called the Golgi stain. And the point of that is it enables you to see individual cells, because the stain fills the cell from one end to the other, and it becomes clear that the brain is made of individual cells. And from this we get what is called the neuron doctrine, which is really just the brain version or the nervous system version of the cell theory. The cell theory is the idea that every living thing is made up of cells and their byproducts. And this was not accepted until about this time. Now, this idea that the brain and the nervous system are made of individual neurons which connect in some way to each other gives you two basic ideas. And what is what's called the law of dynamic polarization? And the other is called either specific connectivity or conductional specificity. So we'll go with that one. Now, the idea of dynamic polarization is that the nerve cell, and therefore the nervous system, is polarized. It has a front and a back end, so to speak, and the information only flows in one direction. It goes in one end of the cell and out the other end. So this is just unidirectional signals. And we'll see how this follows from the structure of the individual neuron. Now, the idea of the conductional specificity is a refutation of the idea that all of the nerves are connected completely, everything to everything. Instead, specific circuits exist with specific cells connected to some cells and not others. It is not true that every cell is connected to every cell. You have specific circuits as you do in any electronic device. And that's what's meant by this. Now, we've been talking here about neurons as if they were the only cell in the nervous system, and they're not. So just for an aside, we want to mention that in the brain, there are what are called glial cells. And the word glial derives from the word for glue, because these were thought to be the cells that held together the neurons. And they do serve a major support function, but they serve many other functions as well. They surround and support the functioning of the neurons. And they don't just provide physical support. They provide material support in that nutrients and other goodies come from the glial cells to the neuron, and the glial cell picks up waste and carries it away. Now, it says in the notes that the glial cells construct the blood-brain barrier. Now, you may remember that the blood-brain barrier is formed because the endothelial cells of the brain capillaries are tightly joined to each other. The actual structure that makes up the blood-brain barrier is the endothelial cells around the capillary. But it is the glial cells that secrete signal molecules that go to the capillary cells that cause them to form tight junctions. And so the glial cells are responsible for triggering the formation of the blood-brain barrier. Now, there are many types of glial cells, just as there are different sorts of neurons, and some of them are listed in the notes, and there are more details in the book. Now, we don't really want to talk very much about glial cells, except to mention how many of them there are. In the brain, there are 10 times as many glial cells as there are neurons. So although the neurons do the actual conducting of signals, they'd be lost without the glial cells. But we're going to ignore them for now. And what we want to do is go back and look, what is the structure of a neuron that enables it to do this stuff, to carry out its function? So I am going to imitate Dr. Feierstein's imitation of a nerve cell. And it looks something like this. Now, there are really four important parts to this nerve cell. So they are, and we'll explain what they are in a minute. This first part is just the cell body or the soma. And this is the, like any other cell body, this is the nucleus, etc. But then you have these branches that go off from the soma. And these are extensions of the soma, and the membrane is an extension of the cell body membrane. And these get finer and finer as they branch. And these are called dendrites. Now, the whole combination of all the dendrites is sometimes called the dendritic tree, which is a little silly because dendrite means tree. So that's the big tree. Now, what's the point of having these dendrites? As we'll see, information comes in through the dendrites and out through the other part. What is the point of having these dendrites? They greatly increase the surface area of what is effectively the cell body. Now, this is a common theme in biology, that you have an extensive infolding of a membrane so that you greatly increase the surface area. You may remember when we talked about the GI tract, we said that the villi and the microvilli give you a surface area equivalent to something like a squash court. Well, here, by having the dendrites, we've essentially extended the volume of this, the area of this membrane by an enormous factor. Now, this we've already discussed before. This is the axon, or the long cable that comes out of the cell. And this membrane is different in composition than the other membrane. Now, you notice that with the dendrites, as the dendrites branch, they get smaller and smaller and thinner and thinner. My art isn't too good, but that's the idea. This is not true for axons. Some axons branch, but when they branch, the branches are the same size as the original. They don't get smaller and smaller. And this is the part that extends from your mid-back down to your toes. It's the axon that makes a cell so long. And in the blue whale, this is the 40-meter part. And the term that's used for that, the fact that if it branches, it's the same size, is that it's isodiametric, meaning it has a constant diameter. Now, Dr. Feierstein said a very good example of this, of the advantage of having, or the effectiveness of this branching business. What state of the Union do you think has the longest coastline in the continental United States? What'd you say? California? Maine? Michigan? No? Rhode Island. And the reason is that the extensive invaginations into the body of the state make the actual coastline the largest of all the continental United States. Even though it's the smallest state, it has the largest coastline. And this is the same principle. Okay. Now, down here, we have the synapse. I'm going to erase the four. It's actually this entire structure where we connect to the next cell is the synapse. Sometimes people refer to the space as the synapse. This is the part of the axon that forms the synapse, so it's called the synaptic terminal usually. And what's going to happen is that information goes in through the dendrites, down the axon, and then the information goes from the end of the axon to the dendrites of the next cell. And this is how we get this dynamic polarization or one-dimensional flow of information, because it always comes in the dendrite and out the axon. So if we were to consider what we're talking about, what we mean is that there are axons of other neurons. This is more the right scale. The synaptic terminal is quite small. But there is a space, a small space, which isn't so clear here, but is clear here, between the end of one axon and the beginning of the dendrite. And there can be many, many dendrites coming into this cell. There can be as many as 150,000. So a vast amount of input or information can come into this cell, and this cell integrates that information and then makes an output. Now, here in this picture, the axons end on the dendrites. They can also end on the soma. Remember that the soma and the dendrites have the same composition. Now, we keep talking about information or a signal coming into the dendrite, into the cell body, down the axon, and then across the synapse to the next cell. What is that signal? And that signal is a change in membrane potential. And that's what I want to talk about next, membrane potential. Now, if you consider a cell, when we talk about membrane potential, we mean that there is a difference in charge between one side and the other. Whenever you separate charges on opposite sides of the membrane, you create voltage. Now, biologists tend to call it potential, while engineers tend to call it voltage. But it's the same thing. And you can look at it as the work it takes to separate the charges on the two sides, the work you put in to do it. Or you can look at, that's sort of maybe the voltage version, the potential version is, if I were allow things to move, what is the push on the charges? And that's, I think, why the term potential is used. Now, when you measure voltage or potential, you always have to measure something relative to something. It's not absolute. So the way it's always done for cells is we measure the inside relative to the outside. So the outside is taken as ground and is considered to be neutral. Now, so if someone says that the potential of the cell is minus 50 millivolts, what they mean is it's negative 50 millivolts on the inside relative to the outside. Now, the units that people use here is millivolts, but they often refer to it as the voltage of the membrane. So there's VM and MV. MV is the units. VM just means membrane voltage or membrane potential. Now, how do you actually physically measure potential? You use an electrode, and this was pioneered by biologists in about the late 1920s, early 1930s. Now, what they use is a glass electrode. What you do is you take a glass tube, and you heat it up, and you just pull it out as fine as you can. And so you have a very, very fine tube, and you stick the tube into the cell. Now, the membrane seals around the glass tube, and you have a salt solution to conduct electricity in the pipette. And you connect this up to an amplifier, and you measure the potential. So you're measuring the inside relative to the outside, which is really the equivalent of the interstitial fluid, what's on the outside of the cell. Now, almost all cells have a potential, but potentials are developed the most and used the most in nerve cells, and then I would say in muscle cells. And so we'll talk first about how it's the significance in nerve, and then next week we'll talk about muscle. Now, what is the usual value for a nerve cell for this difference across the two sides of the membrane? The notes say it's minus 50 to minus 90 millivolts. Dr. Feierstein this morning said it's 60 to minus 90. And then later he said something about minus 50. So this is the range. All of these things are ranges. And somewhere between minus 50 or 60 to minus 90 is the usual potential that you measure if you check out an axial nerve cell. And this is what is called the resting membrane potential, or the RMP. This is, in other words, the difference between the two sides in a cell at rest, poised, ready to do something, but it's not doing anything right now. Now, when you talk about potential in physics and electronics, you're usually talking about electrons moving to create the charge separation. But in biology, you're talking about a separation of ions, not of electrons. So that means that what's being separated here is usually sodium, potassium, chloride, and calcium. There are other ions as well, but these are the major ions that are involved in maintaining and membrane potential and making changes in membrane potential. So these are the charge carriers, if you want to know, put it that way, or you can say this is what gets pushed around by the potential difference. Now, why is the resting membrane potential minus something on the order of 50 to 90 millivolts instead of being zero? Why don't things sort of even out with no charge difference at all? That's what I want to talk about next, which is how you get this resting membrane potential. And we talked about some of this earlier, but not in such detail. Now, let's look at our cell again. And by now you know that in a normal cell, the potassium inside is much higher and the sodium outside is much higher. Why is this? Did this take work to achieve? Yes, it did. It required the splitting of ATP to run the sodium-potassium pump. So the work of the sodium-potassium pump has set this difference up. And the difference is something like the potassium outside is 5 millimolar, the sodium inside is 3 to 10 millimolar, the potassium inside is like 140, and the sodium outside like 130. And these numbers are in your notes. Now, this isn't everything. There are also, of course, negative ions. And there are a lot of those. There's chloride. And then there's also a lot of macromolecules are negative. So we can just put some anions in here. And, of course, there'd be some out here, too. Now, this asymmetric distribution is very important, but it's not sufficient to cause a potential. If it were balanced so that the number of plus and minus on this side were equal and the number of plus and minus on this side was equal, there would be no potential. The reason there's potential is because of two things. First of all, you have to have the asymmetric distribution. You have to set that up. And then you have to have selective permeability. In other words, channels. But we'll leave for a moment how they work and just discuss them without worrying about mechanism, and then we'll come back to it. So let's suppose We had some holes, Dr. Feierstein called them magic holes, which allow potassium to pass and nothing else. So we start with more potassium inside, more sodium outside, but equal charges on both sides. Now, if you have these channels or magic holes which allow only potassium to pass, what is going to happen? Which way is the potassium going to go? Is there an electric push on it? No, because it's even Steven electrically. Is there a chemical push on it? Yes, indeed. As we've discussed before, potassium is in fact going to leak out of the cell. It is going to flow down its concentration to the outside. As Dr. Feierstein said, sort of crowded for potassium in there. Potassium wants to go to the burbs. So the potassium, because there isn't one here, of course, but many, many ions, the potassium is going to start exiting the cell. Now, how does that change the situation? If potassium leaves, but the minuses all stay behind because they can't go through, then we know if this keeps up for a while, now we're going to get an electrical difference on the two sides of the membrane. We have lost positives because they went down their concentration gradient. But as we've explained earlier, why won't all the potassium leak out? The more potassium leaves, what happens to the electric gradient? It gets stronger in the opposing direction. So the chemical gradient, of course, is out. But as the potassium leaves and leaves the stranded anions behind, the cell is going to become minus. Now, this is actually a very small difference, but there is a small minus difference on the inside of the cell. So now, that's the chemical gradient. Which way is the electric push? It's going to be the other way. It's going to be in. And that's why we talk about the electrochemical gradient, because if you want to know what potassium is going to do, or any ion, you have to consider both concentration and you have to consider electric effects. So the sum of the two of them is going to determine what happens. Now, if I let this go then for a while, I'm going to reach an equilibrium, because every potassium that goes out is going to be balanced by a potassium that goes in. The potassium isn't going to sit still. It's still going to dribble out, but it's also going to dribble in, and the rate out is going to equal in. So we're going to reach an equilibrium, and the voltage at equilibrium for potassium is minus 75 millivolts. Now, this value depends on the starting concentration, the uneven potassium levels, which were pushed by the pump. Given the difference that the pump provides, if you let the cell go to equilibrium, you get about minus 75 millivolts. Suppose I go out to lunch. Well, it's a little late. Suppose I go out for tea, and I have myself a little something, and I come back. Will this value have changed? Will the membrane potential be the same? If I let it reach equilibrium, reach this balance, and I go outside, what happens? I come back, I measure it again. An hour later, it's exactly the same. A weekend, a week, a month, it makes no difference. It's going to stay the same. It doesn't take any energy to maintain this. It took energy to build it up in the first place, courtesy pump. But once we reach this stage, it just will stay forever. Now, just to be sure we've got it, what would happen if the cell were selectively permeable to sodium instead? So things look like this. We close the potassium holes and we open sodium holes. Which way will the sodium go? Which way is the chemical gradient? In or out? Well, there's more sodium outside, right? So the chemical gradient is in. Which way is the electric gradient? Well, it's neutral to begin with. Okay, in a real cell, it would be minus. But if we started with this, it would be neutral, but sodium would start to come in. Will the sodium come in until it's equal on both sides? Why not? What happens? We started with a neutral cell, right? Same charge on the inside and the outside, but now what's happened? Sodium has come in, so the cell has become positive on the inside relative to the outside. Well, so what? What does that do in the way of pushing or pulling sodium? If it's positive inside, what effect does that have on the sodium? It's going to push it out because it's going to repel. So again, we're going to reach a balance where the sodium that dribbles in down its concentration gradient is balanced by the sodium that is pushed out. And if we reach equilibrium for sodium, it's going to be about plus 90, I think. No, plus 50. Plus 50 millivolts. Now, if you actually, what was the real resting membrane potential of an ordinary nerve cell? It was minus between 50 and 90. Let's say it's minus 60. Let's pick a number. Not every nerve cell has exactly the same resting membrane potential. But suppose we found one that was minus 60 millivolts. Well, what does that mean? Has it reached equilibrium for potassium? If potassium were allowed to flow freely, would we be at minus 60? No, we would be all the way down to minus 75. If sodium were allowed to flow freely, where would we be? We would be at plus 50. Notice we're somewhere in between. Because there is some permeability to sodium and some permeability to potassium. But is it even Steven? Notice that we're not in between plus 50 and minus 75 exactly. We're much closer to minus 75. And that implies that the permeability to potassium is much higher than the permeability to sodium. We talked earlier about potassium leak channels. There are a lot of these magic holes for potassium, but very few for sodium. People have calculated that there are about 25 potassium holes or channels for one sodium. So now we have a question. If we only had permeability to potassium and we let it balance and we opened those pores and we let the potassium equilibrate, we would reach equilibrium. And even if I went home for spring vacation, it wouldn't make any difference. When I came back, it would be the same. The same would be true if I had only selectability for sodium, permeability for sodium. But I don't. In a real cell, I have a lot of permeability for potassium and a little bit for sodium. So what will happen to this cell if it's minus 60 and I leave it forever? This one will run down because when potassium comes out, it isn't always potassium that goes back in. Potassium can come back and sodium can go in, or vice versa. Sodium can go in and potassium can come out. So if I wait long enough, this will run down. Now it turns out it takes a very, very long time. And normally, the only time it completely runs down is when you're dead. It doesn't normally run down, both because it's extremely slow and because the pump is working to replenish it anyway. Okay, let me, yeah.
Is the only homeostatic pathway for interstitial potassium and sodium concentration in the kidney?
His question is the kidney the only organ that maintains a constant potassium, sodium in your interstitial fluid? It's the primary one, yes. Yeah.
If the potassium equilibrium is -75, how do you get to -90? How do you get...
Okay, that's a good question. How do you ever get to -90? So we have to ask, what determined this -60? What are the factors that made it come out this way? Remember, we've said that different cells have different resting membrane potentials. So what gives you a particular value? And there's two factors here, which I think I wrote down, the four, which are these two. The first one is the asymmetric distribution you start with. The imbalance in sodium and potassium that you start with can be different in different cells. And the second difference is the selective permeability. Some cells are much more permeable to sodium. Some are much more permeable. Well, I don't think anything is much more permeable to sodium. But some are much more permeable to potassium relative to sodium than others. So we're saying if you start with a different concentration, you can change this value. Now, the exact correlation between the concentration on the two sides and the voltage or potential that you get is explained in the Nernst equation, which we have deliberately not discussed. But if you like equations or you've studied it before and you're interested, you can look it up in either of the textbooks. I know it's in Becker. Any other questions? So we've been talking here about so-called holes, which are really channels. And what I want to do now is talk a little bit about the structure of channels and how the opening and closing of channels causes changes in the membrane potential. So if this is a bilayer, of course, has a core of lipid, and water-soluble material cannot pass. So a pore, or a channel, is composed of transmembrane proteins, which here are sliced, we have a cross-section, and they form a water spill filled space or pore in the membrane. So that now, since this is water filled, water soluble material, such as ions, can move either in or out of the cell, depending, of course, on the electrochemical gradient. Now, we've talked about channels before, but what are their critical features, especially the ones that matter here? First of all, they're highly selective. There are channels that allow anions but not cations. There are channels that allow cations but not anions. There are those that allow sodium but not potassium, and potassium but not sodium. So they're very selective. They also have a specific degree of conductance, meaning how fast ions go through. So this is really the speed. We've explained before that the conductance of most channels is very high relative to other carriers, but also each channel has a specifically different conductance. So some of them are relatively big and allow a lot of things through in a hurry, and some of them require are smaller and require ions to move through in single file. Now, the third thing about them is that they're generally gated. Not all, but most channels are gated. And that means that they can be opened or closed. We've explained earlier that that can happen in response to chemicals. They can be chemically gated or ligand gated. And in response to voltage. And also in response to pressure. But for this discussion, we're going to leave that out. Now, the mechanism of gating isn't well understood, and it's thought to be different for different channels. But one possible way it works is to have a piece of the protein here, which can either be that way, in which case the channel is closed, or it can be this way, in which case the channel is open. Now, how do you explain the specificity of channels? I've drawn these proteins here in a sort of blah sort of way, but at least in some cases, we actually know the structure of these proteins. And we know that there are special sequences here. And that what determines the specificity of the channel is the size of the space that goes through the middle, and also the kinds of amino acid side chains you have here. If these are positively charged, then anions tend to go through. If these are negatively charged, it tends to be a cation channel, and so forth. Now, there are a lot of different channels. There are something like 144 different potassium channels, and I assume Dr. Feierstein was referring to people. So you have a very large number of them, each of which has slightly different properties and serves a slightly different function. Now, how do you think we find out the properties of these channels? Most of the genes for these channels have been cloned. And that means you can put the gene on a plasmid and put the plasmid in something like a frog egg. And then you can measure the ability of the frog egg to transmit ions. Now, how do you measure whether ions are moving across and whether the channel is open or closed? Dr. Feierstein said we can see these channels. Now, he didn't mean that you can physically view these, although the crystal structure of some of them is known. What he meant is that you can detect the passage of ions through a single channel. And that's done by what is called the patch clamp technique. Let me explain that briefly. Now, it's a similar idea to this one, except the difference is that you put the electrode just up to the edge of the cell, like that. And generally what happens is the little patch of membrane here seals to the bottom of the micropipette. So what you've essentially got is this. And now you can put solution in here. You can either detach it or leave it attached. But now you can connect this to an amplifier and measure the voltage changes across this membrane. And the current across this membrane, or the voltage changes, occur when individual channels open or closed. This micropipette is so small that it encloses a patch that only has one or a few channels in it. And so you can tell when the channel opens because you change the membrane potential. And if you have two channels open, you get twice as big a change in the membrane potential, etc. So you can detect the opening and closing of a single channel using this patch clamp technique. Are there any questions? Yeah.
Are these channels uniformly distributed, or are they usually kind of regions together, or?
Are the channels uniformly distributed? I think it depends on the cell type. In cell types, well, also, if you look at something, I erased my my neuron. But the channels, for example, on an axon are different from the channels here at a synapse. There's a different set of channels, as we will explain. I talk faster than Dr. Feierstein, and maybe I don't tell as many jokes. So, I'm not finished, but I don't have that much more to say. So if people have questions, don't hesitate to ask. All right. So we've been talking about two kinds of membrane potential. And now we want to talk about a third. We talked about equilibrium potential, and we talked about resting membrane potential, and now we want to talk about the action potential. Now, an action potential is a rapid transitory change in the resting membrane potential. It's rapid and it's transitory. And what it comes from is the opening and closing of a specific set of channels. So we want to say just a few more words about what opens and closes or what gates channels. We mentioned it can be voltage or potential, but it can also be drugs. Drugs or chemicals, that is, ligands. Now, the gating of channels at a synapse, the gating of channels here is, of course, controlled by chemicals. As we'll explain next time, chemicals released from this side affect channels on the other side. But this can be manipulated extensively using drugs. Drugs can block channels either by plugging them up or by interfering with the opening of the gate. And it turns out, or blocking the effect of ligands. And it turns out that many, many drugs affect channels. And one particularly important part are the drugs that affect calcium channels. And these are very important. People use calcium channel blockers. Are very important in controlling blood pressure. And hopefully we'll have time to explain why. But this is a very important class of drugs. Now, Dr. Feierstein mentioned earlier, and I forgot to say it, that when we were talking about glial cells, this is in reference to other disease states, that one of the things that glial cells may do is to control the blood flow through the capillaries of the brain. We know they help set up the brain, the blood-brain barrier, but it's also thought that they influence the flow through the capillaries. And this may turn out to have enormous medical importance because strokes involve blockage of passage through the brain. And if we can manipulate the flow through the capillaries, we can hopefully either prevent or reduce the effects of stroke. But now let's get back to this action potential business. And for this, you want to look at your handout. We're only going to look at that part of it today, but bring it back next time because you'll need it again. What if you were to record from a cell, not while it's just sitting around doing nothing, but while a signal is being carried down? Remember we said a signal is just a change in the membrane potential. So you can record from an axon. Now, we've said that the resting potential is somewhere around minus 50, minus 60. In this picture, it's actually between 60 and 70. It's about here. So this is the resting membrane potential. And as we've discussed, it's negative. If you record, though, from an axon that's having a signal, you record at one point, you see first a small depolarization. And then you see a sudden, rapid polarization. Now, notice what's happening here is we started out negative, and we've reversed all the way up to positive. And then that stops, and we go back down to before, a little under, and back. And this is the rising phase, the falling phase, and the overshoot. And all of this turns out to be due to the opening of the appropriate channels. That here you open a few ligand-gated channels until you reach a critical value. And that causes you to open voltage-gated channels. And that causes a rush of positive ions in. So you not only go up to zero, you actually become positive. And then that stops, and you get a rush of positive out, which overdoes it a little bit, which gives you the overshoot, and then you come back to where you were again. And what Dr. Feierstein will talk about next week is how the opening and closing of channels generates this pattern. Now, why it only took me this long to say it, I don't know. But I think I covered almost everything that he said this morning. I also looked at his note, at the notes that we have posted, and they seem to cover just about everything. So I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any. And if not, I'll see you on Thursday.